Hello, I'm Keith Perron, and welcome to Focus Asia Pacific. Coming up, the World Economic Forum in China wraps up. Cambodian investigative journalists found dead. And Hong Kong Democrats hold on to veto vote. We have this and more on this edition of Focus Asia Pacific, putting the focus on the Asia Pacific. Business leaders from around the world in China gathered in the port city of Tianjin for the World Economic Forum. The annual event rotates hosting between Tianjin and Dalian. Now, it may not be as big as the one that takes place in Davos, Switzerland, but this is changing fast. We caught up with our correspondent in China, Jocelyn Ford. My first question to her is, what is the big difference between the one in China and the one in Switzerland?
Well, it was interesting when they first brought the World Economic Forum to China. It was a big question mark of what it was going to be, because, of course, China doesn't really allow free discussion. And there were a lot of topics that were sort of taboo at the meeting. And that was 7 years ago when they first brought it to Dalian. I attended the inaugural meeting. And this year, I must say, it was quite different. There's been a lot of progress. There was a lot more free discussion, especially by members of the Chinese private sector. They're far more outspoken. They're not sticking to script as they used to. So I think in one thing that what's special about this is that it has helped in some ways, helped China join sort of the international conversation. And what their sort of sales pitch here was that this is the new champions meeting. We're talking with the new players in the global economy. We're talking with especially a lot of young technology developers. They give special awards to young entrepreneurs who are doing cutting edge types of projects and companies. And they're trying to basically, they have a bunch of people called Sherpas who they think will be the future leaders. And I sat next to one of them today, a Chinese businessman who's in his 20s and is poised to be a leader in the future of China.
Now, just out of curiosity, I mean, this is taking place in China, and you said the first one that they had, there wasn't, let's say, the same open discussion that took place now. But I mean, considering that the world situation now is different, there's the economic crisis. We've seen Chinese exports overseas declining. We've seen some shrinking in the Chinese economy. Is this also used as a way to say, look, you know, things are not that bad?
Gosh, I would have thought it was you who was sitting in the speech with Prime Minister Wen Jiabao. That was exactly his message. He was brimming with confidence. We will meet our economic targets. We're going to be fine. The world economy may be in trouble, but we're not. Now, that was a slightly different message that we heard from President Hu Jintao the other day. Was sounding more worried about the international economic situation. So how do you read this speech?
I was going to ask you because you know as well as I do. Quite often, sometimes Chinese leaders they'll make a speech, but you also need like a decoding book to really truly figure out what they're saying.
Totally. And the first, the official part of the speech, it sounded like it could have been a presentation to the National People's Congress. And I hope nobody has ever had to sit through one of these, because it is hours of statistics about how many bushels of grain were harvested and how many kids were sent to school. And it's numbers, numbers, numbers. The audience was overwhelmed with numbers during the speech. And that was all very bright and sunny. What the question... He received one question after from the leader, the head of the World Economic Forum, Klaus Schwab, and he basically said, "Now I want your personal take." And he said this several times, "Personal, just your personal opinion. Don't need to give me your government speak." In other words, he said, "What has been your biggest accomplishment, and what are the biggest concerns you have going forward?" Because this is probably Prime Minister Wen Jiabao's last speech, at least to this forum, and perhaps to an international audience in China, as there's going to be a leadership change, and he will only be in office a few more months. And in response to that, the Prime Minister was a little more honest, more forthcoming about the real problems China faces. And he mentioned several times the gap between the rich and the poor. and that is remains a serious problem. There's a lot of work to be done on this. And though in the past 10 years, well, the prime minister and the current administration has been in power, they've done a lot to try to equalize or bring the farmers, give more income to the farmers. There's still a huge gap there.
Now, of course, the last few months have been very turbulent for China, especially politically. The case surrounding Bo Xilai, the sentencing of his wife, Guo Xilai. Was this discussed at the forum?
I didn't hear a single word except the ones that came out of my mouth asking other people if they'd heard anybody speaking about the scandal of several decades, actually. Being an up-and-coming leader who was supposed to be in potentially in the Politburo, suddenly out of the game because his wife murdered a British business colleague. And you would think again, as I said, discussion is more open now, but that does not mean it is completely open. And this was absolutely, obviously missing from the agenda here, what that means for Chinese politics, what's going forward. There is nothing in the 3-day meeting that I see that could possibly give discussion on this very important question.
So in many ways then, having the World Economic Forum held in China, to me it gives the impression that this is nothing more than a big PR, a big PR move to show the world that, China, look, we're now in the international community. You've got to start taking it seriously. But yet at the same time, many topics, let's say, that would be discussed at the World Economic Forum in Switzerland are not being discussed in China.
Right, I think it is a gradual process. As I said, it's more open than when I first attended. For example, one of China's more independent economists, Professor Li Daohui, today, in his talk, he was rather brazen about, giving advice for the incoming leadership. It was the only person that I heard or discussion I heard of that mentioned the upcoming leadership change. And he said they need to make some radical changes in the next few years, one of which was in making the judicial system independent. And he said, if you want your economy to grow, there are economic disputes. You need to have a judicial system that can handle that. And we don't have one today. But of course, if you read between the lines, for those who were following the Bo Xilai's wife's court case, and there was all sorts of speculation whether the person in court was actually her or a double. What do we believe about the story that was told in court? There was not much evidence supporting this. The decisions came very rapidly. There are a lot of questions about the judicial system. So I think, yes, there, this is not a completely open discussion. However, it is improving. And I think you also have to remember that the PR is not just for China. The PR is also for the World Economic Forum. They need to be seen to be where where business is happening in China. You can't ignore China. They needed to be here. And therefore, if they had to make compromises to be here, my sense is that they have made them. That's purely based on my observation. That's not based on inside knowledge.
What are some of the other key discussions that'll be taking place that people should pay attention to?
Well, what I'm enjoying most is actually the futurists at this meeting talking about how, what transportation will look like in the future, what the next cities will look like. We've got to be environmentally safe. There's a guy today who's talking about, if you are you familiar with 3D printers?
Yes.
3D printers, you can just put in your picture of your little toy doll and it'll spit out a 3D doll. What happens when you can have one of those in your suitcase and you can set them up on street corners? Now we eat, jiaozi, we eat, whatever fast food you like on in Taiwan, I'm sure you've got a lot of delicacies you can pick up on the street. Well, maybe you could pick up a if you needed a coffee, you broke your coffee cup that morning, you could have one made on the street corner just to your specs once these are in. And what would the implications of that be for the environment? Because he was saying that you could take all the plastic bottles for your bottled water or Coca-Cola or whatever you prefer, and those could just be crunched up and thrown into one of these 3D printers and kill two birds with one stone.
Let's talk about the attention on the World Economic Forum. At the beginning, I mentioned that the one that takes place in Switzerland has a lot of media coverage. Some media outlets, they'll do 1 hour a day for the entire thing, sometimes even more. But for this, the one that takes place in China, I haven't seen as much coverage as for the one in Switzerland.
Right. I mean, I think today the organizers were saying that this is as big now is as big as the one in Switzerland, but it doesn't, have the same cachet at this point. It's still seen as more regional. You don't have all of the major CEOs. It's not the, Bill Gates isn't here. It's not the must be place, must be seen here. If you're not invited, you're nobody. So it hasn't reached that stature yet.
But that's probably the level that they'd like to bring it to.
Well, I think if China would like to be the center of the world, then they probably need conferences like this to make them the center of the world and would like everyone to show up. But there were former, having said that, there was a former Australian prime minister, former British prime minister will be there. So, they're getting some people.
Dawson Ford, thank you very much for talking with us today.
Thank you.
And you're listening to Focus Asia Pacific. A Cambodian journalist who is writing extensively on the illegal logging in the country's northern province of Rantanchari has been found dead in the boot of his car. The murder of Hang Sarinoram comes just months after the killing of a well-known environmentalist, Chutvarti. Kandahar Sapati has this report from Phnom Penh.
Hang Sarinoram was a journalist for the local Warak Chunkmai Daily, and his commitment to expose illegal logging by business people and influential officials in the province of Ratnakiri had earned him powerful enemies. His latest story, posted on the newspaper's website just a week ago, had accused the son of a military police commander of smuggling logs in military-plated vehicles and extorting money from people who were legally transporting timber. Ratnakiri police say Mr. Hung's death was definitely murder, but beyond that, little else is known, except that he went missing since Sunday and his body was found on Tuesday in the boot of his car in a cashew nut plantation. U Virak, the president of the Cambodian Center for Human Rights, says standing up against illegal loggers is like fighting the mafia.
There's a lot of money at stake. These are well-equipped, well-financed group of individuals. And these are also illegal activities, and these illegal loggers will definitely do what they can to protect their interests, including the killing of activists trying to stop them.
According to the UN, rampant illegal logging has led to a sharp drop in Cambodia's forest cover from 73% in 1990 to just 57% in 2010. The government has justified the clearing of forest land as essential for economic development, for everything from rubber and sugarcane plantations to hydropower dams. Global Witness has been closely monitoring illegal logging and corruption in Cambodia. Megan McInnes, a team leader, says investment in economic growth is critical for the country's future. But who is benefiting from logging?
Because the illegal logging and the logging sector in general is operating secretly, it's very difficult to see who is benefiting from it. And likewise with the land sector, all the evidence seems to suggest that those who are benefiting from these projects are the large companies, and local communities and the environment are paying all the costs and not seeing any of the benefits themselves.
U Virak says that often companies given economic land concessions clear the forest primarily for the timber and not for any agricultural purposes.
80 to 90% of these economic land concessions granted were basically left untouched, except for the fact that many of the companies do want to log the timbers in these economic land concessions. And there's also a lot of speculations going on where they try to split up the economic land concessions and sell them. So there's a lot of illegal activities which contradict to the contracts or the terms of the economic land concessions anyway.
Activists and journalists working closely with local communities to protect the environment from being raped are now being targeted. In April, one of Cambodia's most vocal and prominent environmentalists, Chut Vut Thi, was shot dead by a military policeman after he refused to hand over pictures showing logging in the southwestern province of Koh Kong. Megan McInnes says, instead of being held up as heroes, these activists are being persecuted.
It's extremely important that the government supports them. These local activists should be held up as the heroes in Cambodia because they're the ones trying to protect the country's natural assets, such as its forests, but instead they're being persecuted.
Since his murder in April, there has been no independent or comprehensive investigation into Chut Vut Thi's death or any formal explanation as to what had happened on that fatal day. Likewise, Ubirak does not hold out any hope that there would be a comprehensive investigation leading to a prosecution for Hang Sarai Udom's death.
Given the government track record of investigating into journalists killed since 1993, there were 11 journalists killed, and in this case the number goes to 12. And until today, there's not a single prosecution of anybody.
Hong Kong's Democrats have retained their critical legislative veto vote over the constitutional change, with the final official count after Sunday's election. The results showed pro-democratic candidates gaining 4 seats, while pro-Beijing parties gained 6 seats. The Democratic Party's Hong Kong best-known pro-democracy party lost 2 seats despite expanded assembly, prompting Chairman Albert Ho to announce his resignation. Sen Lam speaks to the outgoing chairman of the Hong Kong Democratic Party, Albert Ho.
Well, it's more than a little disappointment. I thought we had been quite badly defeated. We have lost 3 incumbent seats in the direct election constituency. And so I have to accept political responsibility for this defeat.
Why do you think the Democratic Party lost quite so badly? Some analysts are saying that it's partly because you did a deal with Beijing to expand the number of seats in LegCo, provided an advantage to Beijing. Do you agree with that reading?
First of all, I don't agree that the political reform package resulted in any political advantage in favor of Beijing. In fact, it's otherwise. It has resulted in a political advantage to the general public in Hong Kong because it has created 5 more directly elected seats on territory-wide basis and also 5 super-functional seats, a very wide franchise enabling 3.2 million people to vote. So I think it is a positive step forward. However, it has been a controversy, I agree. Some people are disappointed. We have lost some support, although on the other hand, we managed to gain some other new support. Overall, I think there has been a change in sentiment. The society of Hong Kong has become increasingly polarized in the last 2 years. So even those who might have found our deal, our negotiation acceptable, nowadays they thought that they would rather prefer some other more radical parties.
Why do you think the pro-democracy parties failed to capitalize on the groundswell of anti-Beijing sentiment in recent weeks, particularly over the patriotism classes issue? Why do you think you failed to translate that into votes?
Actually, the support in favor of the pan-democracy camp has remained majority, has remained a majority share in terms of the votes casted by the general public. However, because there are many more new parties formed in the last decade, so the votes were shared and split between these various newly formed parties. I can say that all the total vote shares obtained by the pan-democracy parties is still in the majority compared with those casted in favor of the pro-establishment parties.
All things considered, it would seem that it wasn't such a bad result for the General Democrats, given that you still have the numbers, I understand, in LegCo to exercise a veto.
Yes, I agree. We have 28 out of 70, so we still retain the critical one-third.
So how does the political landscape look to you now for the next 4 years? Do you think it might pave the way for the direct election of the chief executive by 2017?
We will certainly try to unite and strive for the realization of universal suffrage for election of the chief executive in 2017 as promised by the National People's Congress Standing Committee of China. Since we have a timetable, so we will stick to it, we will fight for it, and in case there is any indication that there would be retraction from this promise, obviously there would be a very strong momentum for movement or for pressure to be exerted on both the local government and the central government in Beijing.
And of course, the heir apparent in Beijing, Xi Jinping, has been overseeing Hong Kong affairs for the past 5 years. Do you see speedier reforms when he takes over the reins in Beijing?
That is something I don't know, to be frank. He's quite a stranger to the Hong Kong people. We don't really know how he would going to handle the question of political reform both in Hong Kong and China.
That was Albert Ho, the outgoing chairman of the Hong Kong Democratic Party, speaking with Sen Lam. China has posted some less than sparkling economic data, with figures for August showing imports falling as exports grew only moderately. There are also some indications that inflation may be on the rise. All of this has prompted concerns that China may not meet its 2012 growth target of 7.5%. That's bad news for China's trading partners in the region like Papua New Guinea, with its extraction industry-driven economy. Helen Hoffman has more.
China is experiencing its weakest economic growth since the global financial crisis in 2007. Figures for August showed there were falls in imports, lackluster growth in exports, plus indications inflation is on the rise. Thao Wang is the chief China economist for UBS Securities. She admits the latest figures paint a grim picture, but insists it's not all bad news.
Over the last few days, we have the latest data from August, and that shows that China's economy is still hovering around the bottom, with economic activity remains weak, with industrial production growth slowing, exports pretty weak. But there's also positive signs in the sense that the property sector, both sales and construction activity, are rebounding after a number of quarters of slowdown. In the meantime, the government has emphasized the increase of public infrastructure spending to help support growth as well.
But the focus seems to be on domestic growth. Is what's happening a concern for global economies? In our case, we'd be looking at the Pacific Islands.
Right. Well, China is trying to rebalance its economy for, and reorienting from, you know, reducing the reliance on exports. If you're Australia and the exporter of major commodities to China, the pickup of or the potential pickup of China's domestic demand is a good story, right? Because if China is relying on exports, then that's not good news for Australia.
Along with countries like Brazil and Germany, demand from China was responsible for driving the global economy. In the Pacific, resource-rich Papua New Guinea was one of the biggest beneficiaries. So, if China's economy continues on a downward trend, it stands to be one of the biggest losers. However, China has indicated it's committed to boosting domestic growth. And Ron Seddon, the president of Port Moresby's Chamber of Commerce, is hopeful that will protect PNG in the short term.
From a Chamber of Commerce point of view, we're actually just watching but not only China, but also to see where Europe is going, to see whether it's going to have an impact on us. You know, we're not doing an enormous amount with China at the moment. I know that they're we're resource rich here in Papua New Guinea, and they're very much a user of the resources. But I guess we just have to follow pretty much what our government says and what the Asian Development Bank and other agencies say, to, you know, that short term we shouldn't be overly concerned.
But what about further down the line? Wayne Golding represents Papua New Guinea on APEC's Business Advisory Council. Last month, he attended the APEC Finance Ministers meeting in Moscow, as well as the subsequent meetings and leaders' summit in Vladivostok. He said the situation in China featured heavily on the agenda, with many Asian countries saying they were seriously feeling the impact of a slowdown in consumption.
I asked him what this might mean for Papua New Guinea.
We did a comparison between the GFC and this current round of reductions in the global economy. In the GFC, we recall extraction industries still performed pretty well. In fact, extraction industries showed a growth in price and volume during post-GFC. This time, the crisis is completely different in the sense that we have a financial slowdown, but not only do we have a financial slowdown, but the pricing of commodities has also slowed down. And of course, quantitative imports into China of raw materials, medium-grade goods, and finished goods are also slowing down. And therefore, this is now a double whammy, if you like to put it that way. And for Papua New Guinea, we're basically extraction industry-driven economy, although we have a strong domestic agricultural base. But with the extraction industry showing contraction in price and quantitative deliveries, what we have is also a slowdown in project initiation and, of course, the amount of money that's available for exploration.
It's expected that if the slowdown continues, major mining companies will begin deferring projects. For the moment, PNG hasn't felt the tremors from China. But like many others around the region, its economists and the government are watching developments closely.
And with that report from Helena Hoffman from Papua New Guinea, we've come to the end of this edition of Focus Asia Pacific. So on behalf of the whole team that helped put the show together, this is Keith Powell wishing you all. We'll see you again very soon. To end off today, here's Utada Hikaru from Japan with Can I Keep a Secret? Bye-bye, everyone. Can you keep a secret?